Good morning to everyone, and welcome to this noontime lecture on Kautilya and the Arthashastra, Lessons in Statecraft. I'm Larry Goodson of the Department of National Security and Strategy, and also Seminar 11. It's my seminar this year. Ready to take the fields of softball today, weather permitting, and hopefully conquer in the way that Kautilya recommends. So it was about 6 years ago that we introduced Kautilya into our curriculum. And our intent was twofold when we did that. I just want to give you this little bit of history. First, we wanted other non-Western theorists of war beyond Sun Tzu or Sun Tzu, which you also have for your class tomorrow, to help war college students develop a wider aperture about human thought on war. To that end, you might also consider the thought of Genghis Khan, Mao Zedong, Khalid ibn Walid, Hassani Sabah, and Miyamoto Musashi as other non-Western theorists who've been important in human history and the application or their thought about the use of force and military power. Second, and for me in some ways more importantly, we wanted to expose our students to statecraft theorists. Statecraft is the art of using the instruments of power, so if you will, the dime toolkit as you've studied it thus far here at the War College, to achieve the interests of the state. Most of us Westerners grew up thinking of Niccolo Machiavelli as providing the ultimate expression of statecraft. But as you know from your reading from Roger Boucher on Kautilya, Max Weber told us in 1919 that compared to the Arthashastra, The Prince, Machiavelli's classic work, The Prince is harmless. Immediately upon introducing Kautilya to the curriculum, the War College faculty found that while Clausewitz, Sun Tzu, and other theorists were very familiar to our students, Kautilya was almost unknown. Indeed, the first time I gave this lecture, the room that you're in was full not only of students, but also of faculty who were here trying to, like Al was just saying, who were here going, oh, I've got the class on this tomorrow, I'd better revisit this thinker. And so I decided then, based on that experience, and I've maintained it in this lecture ever since, that I would help everyone out by doing the unthinkable at the Army War College. That is, I will give you the answers today and not just ask you a bunch of questions. Your TWS course focuses on some central questions for the course on pages 1 and 2 of the course directive. You are encouraged to think about how each strategist or theorist of war answers those questions. What is war? Why do wars occur? How are they fought? How do they end? Right? There are a set of questions like that. And at the end of this lecture, I'm going to answer these questions for you with respect to Kautilya. So if you didn't do the reading, you're in great shape, because I'm going to give you those answers. So those are my credentials for delivering this lecture. My major field for my PhD is IR theory, international relations theory. So Seminar 11, we've been talking a lot about realism, liberalism, constructivism, level of analysis, sovereignty, all those concepts from that stuff. My focus area within that field is war and conflict studies. As a regionalist, I not only focus on the Middle East, obviously, if I'm the professor of Middle East studies, but also on South Asia. Of course, we started on that several years ago. In 1986 and 1987, I did my fieldwork for my dissertation in Pakistan and Afghanistan, where I spent a good bit of time with the Afghan Mujahideen and their supporters. That would include some of the Arab folks who were there under Osama bin Laden. And as you see in that picture, I demonstrated the ability to grow a marvelous beard, which, as you can see from me here, is no longer quite that glorious dark color that it once was. I also want to show you this picture just for a second, just for a little detour into a cultural lesson. This is me sitting at the dais of the emergency Loya Jirga, or the Grand Assembly that selected Hamid Karzai in 2002 for Afghanistan as the transitional president for that country. I served as one of the international monitors for that first post-Taliban election. The elections took place in three phases, first in the districts, then the provinces, then in the big tent in Kabul. That was in the big tent in Kabul, where I was the advisor or the technical advisor to the Loya Jirga Commission for elections. So those people around me were my poll workers, if you will, the people that were in charge of the actual polling that we did at the end. My phase one and two elections were in the West. So any of you who know Afghanistan knows that that's where Ismail Khan was the emir. He was considered the emir of the West. For fun, I sometimes tied my headcloth like Ismail Khan, as you can see in that picture if you know Afghanistan and know Ismail Khan. When I got to Kabul, the delegates were arriving from the provinces. Contractors were still working on the site, and I was walking over to the big tent. I passed some of the delegates from Herat, where Ismail Khan was from, and they recognized me, and they sort of teasingly said to me, "Amir Saab," meaning, you know, Mr. Amir, meaning, we know that you look like Ismail Khan, like that. Then I passed some construction workers. I went by, I heard in this perfect sort of California Western twang, "Dude, I didn't know Jerry Garcia was here at this thing." And I realized then that the cultural prisms we had, you know, that we have of how we see the world really shape how we see the world. So I give you Kautilya now in the spirit of that. So what I'm going to do is follow Craig Nation's approach. He gave you Thucydides with regard to the six questions, right? Who, when, where, what, why, and how is the order I'm going to give you those questions for Kautilya and the Arthashastra. So here we go. Kautilya was also known as Chanakya or Vishnugupta, or is also known, depending on which part of the world you're from and how you see it. He was the kingmaker or the first minister or the prime minister of the great Mauryan ruler Chandragupta Maurya in the period that you see there, 340-297 BCE. That was the time of Chandragupta, who founded the Mauryan Empire, which is, you can see his area of rule sort of stretching from virtually all of present-day Pakistan and Bangladesh, and then the northern part of India. A little more on that in a few minutes. Kautilya is also considered the first great realist, and some would consider him the greatest of realists in the sense of being the purest realist, or as I call him in seminar 11, the stone cold realist, maybe the classical realist. And you see the quote that I referenced just a moment ago, compared to the Arthashastra, Machiavelli's The Prince is Harmless. We believe that the Arthashastra, and there's debate about this among scholars, that it was written by multiple people, kind of like the Sun Tzu, or it was written by one person, but we're not quite sure of the time. But we believe that it was written between the 4th century BCE and the 2nd century Christian era, so in that period of time, if it was written by someone other than Chanakya Kautilya. He lived during the period that you see there from 370 to 283 BCE, and he lived, as you see, in the northern part of the Indian subcontinent. Now, I think you have to think about Chaldea just as you have to think about Thucydides or Clausewitz the other day or Jomini or any of these theorists that are coming that you haven't yet heard about or read, in the context of the period of history and the area in which they lived. So Chaldea was studying at one of the ancient universities in the world, and I'm talking about Taxila here, which is in present-day Pakistan, or its ruins are. And he went from there across India to Magadha, right here, kind of in the Orissa, western Bengal part of India today, where he was insulted by the ruler. So he decided he would overthrow that ruler, this is the story anyway, and replace him with this young, impressive fellow he had met, Chandragupta Maurya. And he did so using clever deception, which if you read the Boucher reading, we don't give you the actual Arthashastra because it's tedious, hard to follow, and maybe not even translated very well. So we gave you the Boucher reading. If you read that, you got the clear impression, I'm sure, or you won't have to read it because I'm giving you all the answers. Don't tell the dean I said that. Oops, this is probably being broadcast, isn't it? Oh, dear me. Actually, it's a short reading that I picked out, so, you know, it's not a bad reading. But anyway, you'll get the impression that deception is a key part of Chaldea's theoretical approach. So the other bit I want you to get is that this is the so-called Mahajanapada period of Indian history, where you have all of these states, as you see up there, one of 16 states in northern India, northern subcontinent. I don't mean India, the state today, but the region that we know historically as the Indian subcontinent. And you had all these little states that are kind of pitted against each other, neighboring city-states. So you've recently done a paper on the Peloponnesian War. You have a familiarity with this situation. However, after Chandragupta comes to power, you see that the Mauryan Empire is created. Now, this room is full of Americans like me who went to public schools and don't know much about world history, except, you know, the little bits that they tell us about in public schools. So the Mauryan Empire, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it probably was just at most mentioned in passing one day, if that. Scott over there is saying, no, I've never, you know, we never even touched on it. So just to give you a couple of historical facts, this would expand to be one of the largest empires in the world in its time. 50 to 60 million people, or at that time, 33 to 40% of the world's population was under the Mauryan Empire. So if you think about that in present-day terms, that's pretty huge. At its height, the Mauryan Empire had an army of more than 630,000 men, which would make it the eighth largest in the world today. They had a whole capability. I don't even want to compare it to corps or divisions or whatever. But if you heard my podcast on War Room with Jackie Witt about this, you know that I talked a little bit about war elephants. They had lots of war elephants. Okay, that sounds funny to us today, but if you put it in the context of the time, the war elephants are, you know, aircraft carriers or F-35s or tank formations. I mean, they're big capabilities to bring on the battlefield. So, what is the Arthashastra, which is the core of this man's work? It is translated by most of its readers as the science of politics or the science of political economy. It's the oldest surviving piece of literature from this era that is of this field of sort of a mirror for the prince, right? That's Machiavelli's notion of it, that this is a handbook to help the leader, the king, the prince, the general, to do his business as the leader of a society. It's divided into 15 books. I think the War Room write-up about it has a mistake and says it's divided into 14 books. It's divided into 15 books, and they cover everything you can think of: economics, law, politics, the behavior, the duties of the ruler and the lesser officials underneath the ruler, military and logistics matters, infrastructure, spies and intelligence. There's a big section on that, including a whole thing devoted to how to make different kinds of poisons, really kind of obscure and frightening reading. And then a section on foreign policy. This text was lost in the 12th century, although it was known throughout Indian history. So, I mean, people knew of it during the period when it was lost. It was rediscovered by Rudrapatnam Shamashastri in 1904, who found it on palm leaves. You see the image of it there at the Oriental Research Institute in southern India, and published in translation in 1915, in the first translation, which is the version that is in our library. So this is another of these ancient bits of literature that tells us, it's written in Sanskrit, by the way, which is very different from English in terms of your ability to take the meaning and understand it exactly. I'm going to do my best with that here in just a bit. So this is the one of these ancient bits of literature that tells us about how to use the instruments of power to achieve national interests. Why do we study the Arthashastra? I'm going to kind of go in a different direction. I'll come back to the how in just a few minutes. It's not only a manual of statecraft, but as Boucher says in your reading, Machiavelli would have been easily outmatched by generals reading either Sun Tzu or Cautilla. And Al was joking with me earlier that in the last couple of years, when we get to the comprehensives, when we get to the end of course papers, when people are writing about which theorist really, you know, helps them understand the world better and that sort of thing, we found that students increasingly are saying, kind of dig this Cautilla guy because he's really summarizing things that that the others don't quite do. And I wouldn't say it's because of, if that's true, and I've observed the same thing that Professor Lord observed, that a lot of students are saying that, not so much to me, oh, he's the Cautilla guy, we have to go tell him Cautilla is great, but I hear it from my colleagues, I see it in the comprehensives that I'm sitting in on and so forth. And I think the reason for that is not so much that Cautilla has some interesting insights, although I think he does, and I'm going to give you those, but I think it's because he's a statecraft theorist. He's trying to talk about using all the instruments of power, not just sort of how do we use the military on the battlefield, but how do we use diplomacy and economics and information to achieve national ends. And so that's what I just want to tell you one other thing about what he says in terms of IR theory, and then I want to talk about how he says you use power. So with IR theory, you look at this, political realism, anarchic international system, power is the key to state security. Oh yeah, he's a realist, right? I mean, if you remember the readings on the theories, this is clearly realism. And in his day, at his time, the point of strategy is conquest, because he lives in a world where it is conquer or be conquered. The Mahajanapada period is, okay, I've got all these neighbors, and if I don't conquer them, sooner or later, they're going to try to conquer me. So I've got to build my capability, and I've got to conquer, or I'm going to be conquered. So if you want, you see that I put that up there in the context of ends. Those are the ends. What are the ways? Well, all ways to achieve conquest can be used. There are no sort of constraints or rules except those that are there in the religious context of the time, right? Which is Hinduism, Buddhism, and that part of the world, in that era of history, those notions about what is virtuous and not virtuous behavior. And we could talk a bit about that as we go along as well. And then what are the means? Well, the reason that this text is viewed as the political economy, the science of political economy, is that although we read it for the chapters near the end on war and diplomacy and foreign policy, most of the text is devoted to the economic well-being of the people. Why do the people, why is it better for the people to have economic well-being and to be ruled well? Because if the people are favorably disposed to you, the leader, and if your society is economically sound, then you have the resources to pursue conquest. And finally, you have a question in your directive about how wars end. And Kautilya is very clear about this. When all the kingdoms are conquered, peace will obtain. Or if you will, you will have victory, or peace, or a stable end state, or however you want to conceptualize the point of war in the first place. So let me go to his text. How is war to be fought? He says, depending on how you read the text, that there are three types of war. I actually read it as there are four types of war, because in a different point in the text, he adds the one at the bottom, Mantrayuddha, or the Battle of Intrigue, which we'll get to in just a minute. Should be a close quote there, Battle of Intrigue. Open war. Let's start with the part that you get from Boucher. Open war, conventional combat operations. Bring out your war elephants, it's shock and awe time, right? I mean, that's open war, it's force on force. And he definitely says this is the most righteous form of war. He also says to avoid this form of war. Okay, we'll talk about that in just a minute. Concealed war, folk, is sort of what we would consider surprise and deception. I think of it as guerrilla war. It's the recourse of the weak king. So if I'm weak and I'm being overrun, I send the forces out to blend into the population, to go into the forest, to strike from time to time, right? That's what I do if I'm the weak king, or if I'm struggling in open war. The part that students all often kind of find really interesting, and I swear this is a true story, maybe my colleagues in the room will remember this, but when I first, the first or the second time I did this lecture, a seminar, not mine, went and had coins made for their seminar that said snakes and concubines on one side and Kautilya on the other side, because they really kind of thought the whole silent war thing was, I guess, missing in our curriculum otherwise, and they liked it, I don't know. But he's very clear. You should use covert action. You should employ secret agents, especially women of pleasing, you know, appearance and what have you, to get in close to the ruler or the generals, sow dissension, maybe slip a cobra into somebody's bed, or whatever. So, using assassination, bribery, disinformation, propaganda, dirty tricks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is the silent war piece of the how do you use war. In a later part in the text, He also talks about war by counsel, by which he means diplomacy, where he says this is a subtle act of war. Diplomats are warriors. They wear a different uniform. They have a different skill set than the guy riding the war elephant, right? But they're there to make treaties, to do things to delay war until the conditions are right. They make treaties that are made to be broken because allies are eventually going to be future adversaries or enemies. I think I said in that podcast, think of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact by the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany that basically said, we won't fight each other, with both sides knowing, nah, we're just buying time. Sooner or later, one or the other is going to attack into Poland, and then we're going to fight each other in World War II, and that's what happened. So these are the four types of war. These are a few thoughts that he said about war, and I want you to think about them in light of the readings and the subjects you've already covered in your seminars. Basically, his view is avoid war, by which he means avoid open war, because one can lose a war as easily as one can win. Open war is inherently unpredictable. Open war is also expensive, so avoid it. In seminar 11, we like to quote Shakespeare and Julius Caesar, who said what? Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. Now, that specifically refers to the medieval English and other approaches to war, which said, okay, we've defeated the enemy on the field, and now we're giving the order to cry havoc, which means off to rape, plunder, pillage, and all the other atrocities that were common in those days at the end of, you know, combat operations. But it's come to be a metaphor in the modern era for us going, boy, war's unpredictable. Once you let slip the dogs of war, you don't quite know how it's all going to play out. And so open war is expensive, unpredictable, it's dangerous, it's risky. So you should avoid it. Instead, you should try the upaya, the sadgunya. I'm going to talk about these here in just a second. Understand the opponent, seek to outwit him. And only when everything else fails and circumstances are best for it would you resort to military force. About the upayas, the four strategies, these are what? I don't know if anyone knows. Saman. All right. Go ahead. Yes, the four strategies. Sam, Dana, Beda, Danda. All right, which are, in order, conciliation, gifts, dissension, and force. Which, if you're an IR theorist, and this is how some of us end up in the Arthashastra in the first place, these are very similar to Hans Morgenthau's discussion of balance of power theory, one of the great realists in the 20th century. He said, the balance of power can be carried on either by diminishing the weight of the heavier scale or by increasing the weight of the lighter one. His section on this in his great book, Politics Among Nations, The Struggle of Power, says, divide and rule, compensation, armaments, and alliances, or these four ideas, these four strategies, are how you use power. Or, if it's easier for you to think of it in light of the recent readings you've done, think of your author, Joseph Nye, who's talked about soft power and hard power and smart power and how you use different instruments of power to in different strategic ways. Maybe you can think about all of this in relation to the ongoing crisis with North Korea. Which strategies would you use? Would you try to conciliate? Would you try to provide payments or gifts? Would you try to sow dissension? Or would you try to use force? I'm also going to talk about Sadgunya here in just a moment. This is that. The sixfold royal policy or the sixfold foreign policy. Are there only peace and war? When you think about those questions about war, is it just peace and just war? Or are there other states that are somehow in between? Kautilya breaks it down into six forms of policy, and I've laid them out for you there on that slide. And he argues that the king or the state's relative strength or weakness is what determines the type of policy that the king should adopt against another state based on the judgment of that state's strength and weakness. So that's the relative piece of it, right? So if you are strong against another state, for example, you might engage in offensive operations to achieve your national interests. If not, you might adopt something less offensive, perhaps marching, perhaps a temporary peace, perhaps seeking an alliance, and so on. And it's actually more complex than that because, of course, there are multiple actors in this equation, which leads us to maybe the part that's most known in the West, which is the Mandela theory of foreign policy, all right? Based on the notion of the Raja Mandela. Mandela is a very common concept in this part of the world. In this case, the circle of kings, right, Raja, or the circle of states. So in this diagram here, your king is the conqueror. He's in the middle of this circle, or actually looks more like some DNA, mitochondria, but anyway, he's in the middle of this sort of diagram of all these states. And he says, two states sharing a common border are intrinsically hostile to each other, or the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which is often attributed as an Arab proverb, and it is an Arab proverb. Its original expression is in ancient Hindu literature, and we normally attribute it in this context to the Arthashastra and to Kautilya. So it's very simple. If David here is my neighbor, I'm going to make an alliance with Aziz, and we're going to carve up his kingdom, right? If we judge that the strength and weaknesses and so forth are going to work out, because behind Aziz is Ryan, and David's maybe going to try to make an alliance with Ryan, right, and so forth, and so, and someone's behind me, and so forth, and so on. But if David seems to be Poland in the earlier Molotov-Ribbentrop pact example that I gave to you, then yes, he is. And we're going to try to do what Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union at the beginning of World War II did to Poland, to David. But then what? Now I've got half of his kingdom, or maybe all of it, and now who in this case becomes my enemy? Oh, Aziz. I loved Aziz 5 minutes ago, but now I love Ryan, who's on the backside of Aziz. And I mean, this is, I'm presenting it in a simplistic fashion, but this is, in a sense, how the Mandela theory operates, as you see in this slide right here. And so in this matter, or in this manner rather, eventually the conqueror, if he is skillful and if he judges correctly relative strength and weakness, can conquer the world and peace can obtain for all. And by the way, the focus of this, there's a lot of ethical and morality dimensions in the Arthashastra, even though this is presented as a great treatise of realism. It's sort of, you know, realism with a healthy dose of, hey, the people provide the foundation of your ability to do things, so don't abuse the people. So Aziz and I aren't going to attack David in the first place unless he's a bad ruler and the people don't really like him, because, right, if the people are very supportive of him, he's going to be tough to defeat. So we don't want to attack him if he's a good ruler. On the other hand, hey, I got secret agents. They can go in there and sow dissension, spread propaganda, slip cobras into people's beds, et cetera, et cetera. They can do things to kind of help create the conditions for me to eventually conquer him, right? And I need to conquer him because it's conquer or be conquered. So there's a healthy dose of both defensive and offensive realism in this, if you want to think of the modern derivations. This was back before we divided it up in those ways. So, consequently, when I do take over his kingdom, I don't want to do it in the way that is going to turn the people against me. I just want to get rid of him. And then the people can join with my people. And so all along in the background, the well-being of the people is important to this science of politics or of political economy. It's not just about conquering. Therefore, these are the elements of sovereignty that he writes a great deal about. The king, and under the king, the minister, the country, the fort, the treasury, the army. I put in parentheses some sort of modern-day interpretations of those words. So if you're studying determinants of power, these would be the determinants of power. If you've got a good, strong government, if the people are loyal and have good morale, if your infrastructure is sound, if your economy is sound, if your military is strong, then you're probably a strong nation relative to a lot of others. The capabilities of your friends and your enemies, those are also part of the equation. Remember the Peloponnesian League and the Delian League, right? I mean, there's that whole piece to the puzzle as well that goes on. And all of these are the elements of strategy. And so, mindful that the commandant is coming in a bit, and mindful of the promise I made at the outset that this would save you some heavy reading if you had strategic softball this afternoon or something like that that was going to get in the way, here are my answers to what I consider the five questions. I know that we had multiple questions in past years. We've had four questions. We've had five questions. Now we have various sets of questions kind of scattered throughout the directive. But I'm going to summarize it in terms of five core questions. What is war? This is what Kautilya says war is, a way to increase power, although, and I give you his quote there, if there is equal advancement in peace or war, one should resort to peace, or in any event, avoid open war, which is risky, costly, right, and uncertain. Another way of saying risky. Why do wars occur? Or put another way, what is the object of war? Well, clearly his worldview is conquer or be conquered. War is for conquest, and after having conquered the world, the conqueror shall enjoy it, which by which he means in the context of Hindu and Buddhist traditions as well, but Hindu traditions, that it doesn't mean he should enjoy it in a sort of hedonistic way. Woohoo, I'm the big ruler. No, it's not like that. It's he should then create this sort of just and stable society where everyone's well-being is improved. How should war be fought? Well, defense of the realm, of course, is necessary, but it's not sufficient. since it's a conquer or be conquered world, you've got to actually conquer. So that leads you to the four types of war that I talked about earlier, the four strategies, the sixfold royal policy or foreign policy, and the mandala theory. These are all ideas offered to the literature on war that that Kautilya gives us. And how are wars won? Well, now you're back to the type and the purpose of war. Let me make a small digression here. We do have a little bit of time. So one of the questions I've been asking my students in Seminar 11 is whether war or peace is the natural state of human existence. So if you're Kautilya, for whom your Secretary of State is a five-star general, just like your chairman of your Joint Chief of Staff, well, he's a four-star general, but anyway, you know, a very senior official of the state, who is a warrior, because he or she is out there, you know, making treaties to delay things, to extend things, to set things up for 20 or 30 years down the road when one day I'm going to go to war against Ryan, having conquered David and Aziz, right? So down the road, eventually that's going to happen. So you might, if you're Kautilya, you might say, so the natural state of existence is war. We're always in a state of war. We may not actually be fighting in an open sense with our war elephants or, you know, whatever the modern day equivalent is. We may not be fighting anyone in that sense, but we're at war. I got secret agents in David's country sowing dissent, right? I've made a treaty with Aziz that I'm going to break one day, so my diplomats are doing that. So my chief of secret agents, my CIA chief, is busy in David's country. My Secretary of State is busy in Aziz's country. My CENTCOM or PACOM commander or whatever is busy in Ryan's country, right, building partner capacity and all of that. Or maybe not building it as well as we might, since sooner or later we're going to take Ryan on, right? So all of these things are going on because I see the world as being in a kind of permanent state of conflict. Maybe war is the wrong term, but a permanent state of conflict, if I'm Kautilya. And then, of course, a corollary of that, as I've already said, is conquest brings victory, yay, but it also changes the equation of states, which is a little bit of an unstable thing to have happen, right? Because maybe conquering David is great, but now what signal does that send to Aziz, Ryan, and all the other people scattered around us? Oh, he might come for me next. Maybe we need to band against him, right? I mean, so all of this kind of, this is not something that's static. It happens in a very dynamic way. And then lastly, are there concepts of enduring relevance? Because that is in your directive this year, right? What do any of these theorists give us? I mean, this guy wrote almost back, not quite as far back as Sun Tzu and Thucydides, but back in the same general era of history, 2,500 years ago. Really? War elephants? I mean, come on. Is any of this relevant today? So here's my answer to that. My recent article or paper, which is about to be published upon revision, as an article which also appeared as a piece of the last National Intelligence Estimate on Afghanistan from October of last year, and a separate intelligence community assessment in February of this year. And we had the National Intelligence Council leadership here for a conference on this here in, I don't know, what was that, April or May? May, I think it was. It was my conference. I should probably remember when it was, but I think it was May. So that is all centered around this idea that I've been talking about, that there's a new great game going on in and around Afghanistan today that is a manifestation of Rajamandala. And I put some alphabet soup there underneath that. Does anyone know all that alphabet soup? So those are the acronyms for the intelligence services of Pakistan, India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia, China, and, oh yeah, the United States. One of our intelligence agencies anyway, right? We have 16 of those, but anyway, one that's not all of, that all of them have. That there is this intelligence game that goes on in and around Afghanistan. Afghanistan being sort of a playing field. I didn't put the NDS up there, which is the Afghan version of the alphabet soup, but I could have. I also put down there the map of the area of New Delhi, the city of Chanakya, Chanakyapuri, which is the diplomatic enclave. When I first gave this lecture, I remember this room was full with people hanging from the rafters. And I remember the Indian brigadier was sitting back there. I won't say his name, non-attribution, right? But at the end of the lecture, we're into the Q&A, and people are asking me questions. And finally, a student turns to this gentleman and says, "Is it true what he's saying?" I mean, you know, words to that effect. Sort of insulting to me, but anyway. And he said, "Well, you know, we don't know Clausewitz in India." Well, we know Clausewitz. I'm just using that as an example. But we know Chanakya. And then he runs for about five, it was really wonderful. He gave a great little mini lecture about all the things that are in the Arthashastra, a lot of little details and things that I just didn't spend time on. But he mentioned, and I hadn't thought about this until then, Chanakyapuri. He said, "You know, I don't even know if the American diplomats in India know that they're in the city of Chanakya, that they're actually on Chandragupta." Let me see if I can point it out here. Chandragupta Street and Panchil Street, right? Which is the five principle or the five principles of peaceful coexistence, the agreement that China and India made. But it really references a much earlier notion in Hindu and ancient Hindu literature. And then if you go further up there, you'll get to Kautilya Street. I mean, this is the diplomatic and rich community within New Delhi, where all the diplomats are. And it is named for this theorist. So maybe that gives you a little bit of insight into what the Indians and the Pakistanis and the people in that part of the world think about the importance or the enduring relevance of this theorist. And then finally, I'll just give you a couple of quick maps. So back in the 19th century, during the period that we think of as the Great Game, right, between British and Russian imperialists during that era, that's what the map looked like. Yeah, there's Afghanistan. Actually, those borders get drawn during the 19th century. But anyway, there's Afghanistan, surrounded by a bunch of little states here and by India, which was much more complex than that back in the 19th century with, you know, 500-plus princely states and so forth. But anyway, it gives you a feeling for what this looked like as we turned into the 20th century. So maybe not all that different from the Mahajanapada period in terms of how the geopolitics on the map looked. So there's Afghanistan today with, you know, the modern map, the current map. So Pakistan is caught between India and Afghanistan, if you think in terms of the mandala theory. Pakistan's big enemy in the world, big adversary, big rival. I don't want to necessarily label it, but who has Pakistan focused its military against since its creation? India, right? So India's the big threat to Pakistan. And then during the last decade, India and Afghanistan established a strategic partnership agreement, right? So now if you're looking at the world through the mandala theory, you're going, oh, I'm David, caught between Aziz and Larry. This is just not going to be good for me. So what is Pakistan? Where does it turn to? Who's its big friend in the world? China. Who's China's rival for supremacy in Asia? India. Or anyway, somewhat rivals. Right? And we could go on and on with this. My point being, and this is the notion of my new Great Game article, my point being that maybe in a part of the world where the diplomatic enclave of New Delhi is named for this theorist, maybe some of these ideas have enduring relevance in the way the intelligence services and the foreign policy communities see their neighborhood and see through the prism of a kind of fundamental realism. Lastly, looking ahead to Al Lord's favorite subject, sea power, when you studied geopolitics, you saw that this could be done on the sea as well as on the land. That maybe Mackinder started out with this notion of the heartland and, you know, the Eurasian center of power. But maybe Mahan and others said, wait a minute, brother, it's the sea lanes that give you power. In any event, when we think of this new great game, we can think about the Indian Ocean and the area around Asia, not just the area overland through Asia, and it's for a reason that China has a one belt, one road notion, that it's through overland through Asia that they want to expand, and through the South China Sea, the Strait of Malacca, the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea, and on to the west by sea as well. And so we have the string of pearls strategy where, and all of them aren't on here, but where China has been building naval installations or upgrading them all around here. These black squares are port authorities assisted by China, and then India has tried to do the same. The most obvious case was when the Chinese built Gwadar in the last decade, and immediately India, in what you military folks call a flanking maneuver, upgraded the port at Chabahar and built the road up to Zaranj in Afghanistan so that there would be, they would be further to the west and closer to the Strait of Hormuz and the oil of the Persian Gulf. Now, more recently, China is building or has been building a port right down the road from our camp in Djibouti. And so I'm waiting for the next Indian move along the Red Sea or the coast of Africa. So again, a modern day manifestation of what we might think of as the mandala theory. And I said finally, but this is the finally part. Thoughts from the Arthashastra. I just leave these with you to read and learn from. My personal favorite, and I know this from when I lived in Pakistan, and ISI and other intelligence folks, since I was there at the height of the CIA-run war against the Mujahideen, or with the Mujahideen against the Soviets, I mean to say, in the 1980s, we used to joke there was an old hotel that a lot of spies would go hang out in Dean's Hotel in Peshawar, where I lived, and we used to say that if I whispered something in my bedroom in Dean's, you know, on a Wednesday evening, it would be known in Rawalpindi at GHQ, you know, down with the Pakistani government, the next morning. So I always like number two. Never share your secrets with anybody. It will destroy you. Don't tell your wife or your husband. Don't tell your kids. Don't tell anybody your secrets. And then lastly, this is what you really need to take away to have a successful year here. Yes, softball success is cool and all that, but really, let not a single day pass without your learning a verse or at least something, nor without attending to charity study and other pious activity. For the life of an uneducated man is as useless as the tail of a dog, which neither covers its rear end nor protects it from the bites of insects. So that's what I have for you on Kaltia. We've got five more minutes if anyone has questions, but otherwise, I hope I have set you up for success in tomorrow's class. Are there any questions? Yes. Yeah.
Why did he think that open war was more righteous than that?
So this goes back to the Hindu understanding of righteous behavior, I mean, would be my answer to this question. And that, you know, you do what you have to do to win, but if I'm meeting you on the open field of battle, this is viewed by people as the righteous way if I'm going to fight a war. Doesn't mean it's the smartest way or the most effective way or the way that comes with the least risk to my own kingdom. And to that end, Danny, if I can just segue off of this. So the theme of my article on the New Great Game is that there are rules that since we labeled these events in modern history, right, the 19th century and now the current one, a great game, that there are rules and that the rules haven't really changed very much. And so not to spoil the scintillating read of my article for any of you, I won't give you all five rules, plus in 3 minutes you have to go see the commandant. So I'll just tell you this one. The one that I think is most relevant in this case is don't play to win. Play not to lose. That's how everyone has traditionally approached the situation in Afghanistan. Think about Afghanistan in light of recent presidential pronouncement guided by H.R. McMaster and, you know, Secretary Mattis and, you know, Secretary Tillerson, presumably, about what we're going to do in Afghanistan. So you don't want to try to go in there heavy and win, because winning exposes you to a lot of risk. You'd rather make sure that you don't lose and try to prevent your enemy from winning. And that's a different strategic approach, and maybe not quite as righteous, but certainly maybe less risky and more likely to produce good results. Yes, one more question, then I'll let you go see the general.
Sure. So I was wondering about the how wars are to be fought, the third option in terms of the secret approach. So in my reading of kind of the six schools of Indian philosophy, which you term as Hinduism, So I was in my reading of the different philosophical schools, there's an equality between the sexes. So I'm just a little surprised, and I'm wondering how you might compare and contrast Yusad Bellum and Yusin Bello with his use of or suggestion that women could be used as a tool of war, which seems to be in contrast with the philosophical schools, which had equality of the sexes. So how did he reconcile the cultural mores of men and women being equal during this time period and actually justifying women as secret agents?
So the answer to that, in terms of the frame that you put it in, is complex and would take too long to say, given the time. However, I'll just say this. he specifically references, hence the seminar that made the concubines and snakes coin, that you're using concubines or professional women, shall we say, and actors, and a whole class of secret agents. The women part goes to the inherent susceptibility, he believes, that powerful men have to the allure of beautiful women that are trying to suborn them. So the modern day honey trap notion that many intelligence services employ very successfully, is clearly something he's talking about, even though this is divorced from some of the schools of philosophy of ancient India that you're referencing. And that's a fantastic question. We can talk more offline. I'm mindful that I was told you had to have 15 minutes because you're colonels, and it might be hard for you to get from here to Bliss Hall in just 15 minutes. So thank you for your attention. I appreciated the chance to talk to you.